This episode and a lot of the other content we produce would not be possible without the kind support of our patrons, especially our producers, Holly and Leanne. Thanks for your kindness. You can become a patron at patreon.com/explorations. That's Patreon, patreon.com/explorations. Welcome to another episode of the Child Care Bar and Grill Podcast. I'm Jeff Johnson, coming to you live from upstairs studios. I'm here with Lisa Murphy.
Hello.
My wife, Tasha.
Aloha.
And author Peter Gray, author of the book Free to Learn. Peter is somebody you've already heard about on the podcast. You've seen copies of his book on the YouTube shots we've put out when we've been talking about it in the past. And we're excited to have Peter with us because the book, I think, is groundbreaking. I was following Peter's blog long before the book came out and sharing information, and it was something that we really eagerly anticipated. Peter, thanks for joining us.
I'm glad to be here, Jeff.
And I'm wondering, we'll get into the book, but I really want to know one thing we talk about in this podcast a lot, and most of our listeners are either childcare providers, early learning teachers, or parents of children of that age group. And one thing we've talked about a lot in past episodes with guests is their origin stories about how they got to be where they are on their journey. And so what brought you to being a passionate advocate for play and to penning this great book?
Oh boy. Well, in the preface to my book, I describe the particular incident that really changed the direction of my research. You know, I'm sure that there were some ways that I was prepared for this before, and there've certainly been many things after that have led me to where I am and where I was when I wrote Free to Learn. But the particular incident occurred when my son was in ninth grade, when he was 9 years old and was in fourth grade. And he had been rebelling in school. This was a suburban, supposedly high-ranked public school. He'd been rebelling in school right from the beginning. He really, truly hated school. I mean, this was clear to him from kindergarten on. He believed it was prison. He believed that it was cruel to be going there. And he just fought it all the time. And we were being constantly called in by his teachers, by the principal, trying to get him squared away on it. Somehow, you know, he managed to struggle. We all managed to struggle through on this through fourth grade, or through almost the end of fourth grade. But he constantly rebelled, and then it finally reached a crisis. Near the end of fourth grade, we had this, you know, I might say that his rebellion was not kind of the typical little kid's way of rebellion, of just acting naughty. You know, what he was doing was kind of more like the schemes of a revolutionary. You know, he would deliberately do the opposite of what the teacher asked to do. So, for example, when it was time to learn how to use punctuation and capital letters, he would decide to write like E.E. Cummings, capitals and punctuation wherever he pleased, or not using them at all, even though he knew how to use them. He would deliberately figure out the wrong way to solve, the wrong way, according to the teacher, to solve arithmetic problems. He'd get the right answer, but he would never do it in the way that the teacher wanted him to do it. And, you know, I would argue with the teachers a little bit. I would say things like, well, isn't it actually kind of clever of him to figure out a way to do it different? Then they would say something like, oh, yeah, but it'll catch up to him someday. If he doesn't do it right now, if he doesn't do it the right way, then he's not going to be prepared for the more advanced kind of math later on. And
meanwhile, he was doing it.
I knew that wasn't true, but I also couldn't convince them of this.
Nor could I
convince him. I mean, I had all these discussions with him. I would say, you know, it would be so much easier for you. It would be so much easier for everybody if you would just follow the rules. You know, do whatever you want at home, but don't. But just follow what they tell you to do at school. And he just couldn't do it. I mean, it was just against his constitution to do what he thought was stupid. And so it reached a point in the principal where, you know, his mother and I were called into the principal's office for this big conference. We had a sort of a pre-conference about it without him in advance. And the goal was that we were all going to present a united front to him. We were going to tell him in no uncertain terms that he had to do what he was told in school. And so the principal was there, the assistant principal, his classroom teacher, an assistant teacher in the classroom, the school psychologist. If I remember right, there's another psychologist that was called in from outside the school. And his mother and me, and we all said our piece. And then he, you know, a little 9-year-old kid looked at us and said to all of us, go to hell.
Wow.
And, can I ask, you know, did he get this from his mother or from you? Were you expecting this out of him, or is he just
We were not expecting that. No, we weren't expecting quite that. We were hoping that this would have an effect, but he absolutely was not going to do with this. And so, you know, his mother and I both started crying at that point. You know, we both realized that he was right. I think that was, I mean, part of us kind of realized it before. But we kept thinking it's really important for him to learn how to conform to society. This is society, the school is. He's got to conform to it. And we also didn't know much about other possibilities. I was vaguely aware of the Sudbury Valley School. I had actually even considered it at one point. But his mother at that time was very much against that idea. And so, you know, we just kept fighting with him about going until it reached that point. And then we both realized that we had to be on his side. We could not be standing there against him. We as parents had to be on his side. So that's when we realized that we had to take him out of that school. It made no sense. And we looked at various sort of progressive schools that were in Boston. They would have been a little hard to get to. They were expensive, but at least at one of them, he would have gotten a scholarship that would have paid his tuition, so he could have afforded it. But when we visited them and he visited them, we realized they weren't going to work for him either. There was a little bit more of a sense of choice and so on, but it was still basically the same thing that he was reacting against.
Just different versions of the same prison?
Different versions of the same prison, you know, and where there's sort of a pretense of freedom, but ultimately you've got to do what the teacher expects of you, except that in a progressive school, the teacher is a little bit less clear about what he or she expects, so you kind of have to guess, you know.
That makes it even more of a struggle.
Because you're still graded, you still have to be passed a law, and there's still determination of what a curriculum is, and it's not the child's ultimate choice of what the curriculum is, and so on. So then we found the Sudbury Valley School. Then we went out to the Sudbury Valley School. And my son immediately thought, well, he had two reactions. First of all, he couldn't quite believe it. He thought there might be some trick going on.
Uh-huh.
But secondly, he thought, if it's true, this is exactly what, in his mind, a school should be. It's a place where children of all ages are present, where there are adults present, and where children learn what they want to learn in their own ways. And there are people to help them if they want help and ask for help, but they don't have to have help if they don't want it or don't feel that they need it. They can study whatever they want. The students have a vote in making all the rules of the school. The students are involved in enforcing the rules so that if somebody is brought up for violating a rule, there's a jury of their peers, which consists of school members of all ages, and so on. So this was a democratic school. It was, you know, my son believed in democracy, and this was exactly what he believed in. He believed in the freedom to determine your own path to happiness, and this was a school that represented all of that. So I was a little bit, I was happy that he was happy, and his mother was delighted that he was happy. As it turned out, she was more immediately accepting than I was of his going to the school, because when she saw how happy he was and how the glow and his old excitement, enthusiasm about learning returned, and the anger began to disappear.
How soon did she see that? Was it like a light switch, or did it take a week or two, or how?
I think probably over the course of a month or something like that, because it took him a little bit of time to adapt,
brighten up
too.
To it. Yeah.
But for me, I worried, well, what if he wants to go to college? How could he go to college after never having done anything like school?
Uh-huh.
And, not that I felt he had to go to college, but I didn't feel like it would be a good idea for him to absolutely close that option off. And so that led me to want to talk to graduates of the school to find out what they had done. Talk to staff members, found out, lo and behold, there were already some graduates of the school, and some of them had gone to college, including some who'd done all of their schooling at this unusual school. So it ultimately led me to do a systematic study of the graduates, and that was a new realm of research for me. I had previously been studying rats and mice and binding of certain hormones in the brain, very different kind of research. I mean, before I did this study, I tried for a while to find some professor of education who would do the study. I thought, this is really an interesting school. I would think that professors of education would be fascinated by this and would want to find out how well it works, since it's been around long enough to have some graduates. So I told various people at Boston College, where I worked. I contacted people at Harvard. There was a professor there at that time who was very much into what he called democratic education, although it was nothing like Sudbury Valley. Turned out neither he nor his students were particularly interested in it. So I finally decided that if there was going to be a study done of the graduates of this very unusual school, I guess I would have to do it. So I, along with a fellow who was at that time a part-time staff member at the school, who helped me make contacts with the graduates, and we found most of the graduates. Most of them agreed to be to answer our questions, and that study absolutely convinced me that the school works as an educational institution. The kids had come from different walks of life. They seem to have different personalities. Some of them had been diagnosed as learning disabled in public school. Some of them had been failing in public school. Some of them, like my son, had been rebelling in public school. Others just came to the school because their parents believed in it right from the beginning. Some came to the school because their sibling came who had been rebelling, and then once the sibling was there, the family decided to send everybody there. So So people came for all kinds of different reasons. You know, there was no grounds for thinking that this was the cream of the crop of kids. And yet, lo and behold, they, you know, regardless of why they came, they seemed to go on to happy young adult lives. At that time, they were mostly young adults when I studied them. So the... And they seemed not to, you know, my worry about going to college was totally unfounded. I mean, kids who had never, ever read a textbook, who had never done anything like a course, seemed to somehow get into college if they wanted to and do well there, which, you know, is shocking when you think about it, right? I mean, we have our whole rationale for why we teach the way we do throughout the first 12 grades is so they could go to college. I mean, ask any high school teacher why she or he teaches what they teach, and it's so they can get into college. You know, right? None of them particularly believe that this is important stuff for living life. They believe it's important to get into college. And here, the study of this group showed it's not even important for getting into college.
How many students did you end up contacting in that? What size sample were you looking at?
There was something like. There were something like 85 graduates at that time. The school had been in existence for probably about 14 or 15 years at that time. It was smaller than it is now. And we defined a graduate as somebody who had been at the school, if I recall correctly, for at least 2 years, although most of them had been there much longer and some had been there for their entire K through 12 years, and having been out for, I think they had to have been out for 1 year at least, and they had to have left not to go to secondary school someplace else. So they left either to go on to work or to travel or to go to higher education. They didn't leave to go to high school someplace else. So that was the way we defined a graduate. Mm-hmm. Most of them had gone through the diploma procedure at the school, which was basically to defend a thesis that they were prepared to go on, that they and different students do that in different ways. But not all of them had, and we still called them a graduate if they had just chosen to leave without doing that process. Some people don't believe in that process. They think that violates the principles of school because that's the one case that does involve some kind of evaluation outside of the person themselves.
It's kind of like I'm ready to go. None of your business.
So there's some people who felt that and. So, you know, we didn't want to exclude them from the study.
Yeah.
So we didn't define them as people who had the diploma. So, you know, we contacted something like 90% of the total graduates at that time, and essentially all of them completed the survey either in written form, or if we didn't get the written form back right away, by a certain time we called them and interviewed them on the telephone. So we really got almost everybody, and there were a number of them who lived close by that we followed up with more extensive personal meetings.
Well, I think that willingness to participate in something like this says a lot about the school just on its face like that, because, you know, you go to a public school in any community in town in the country and ask students to give feedback on something like that, and I'm guessing you wouldn't have that kind of participation.
That kind of numbers, I think it probably I think that that's right. I think that they felt very much like this is a special school, and they really want to talk about their experiences of having gone to this school. They felt very proud about the school. It's possible that another small school like this, where there's a certain degree of school spirit, and if you contacted them personally, it's possible that you would get responses similar to that. But I think you're right. I don't think it would be that number.
Do you have?
These were pretty extensive. I mean, these were questionnaires that took some real time to fill out.
Yeah, I read some of the comments in the book. Just very detailed and thought out. And it's just, I was just happy to read that people are feeling this way about the way they were educated, which is a good thing. Do you have any feelings or thoughts about why none of the education people that you approached about doing this research were interested? Was it something? I sometimes we get a feeling that people are so tied into the way the system is as it is that they're unwilling to kind of look at other options because there's already so much invested in the system we have. Did you feel any of that in there, or was it just no time for it on my schedule?
I think, yeah, it's, different people had different ways of saying it, but I think that I think that what it came down to is that I think that the most stated answer was that this is a little school and it doesn't represent the kinds of major problems of education that they're interested in. So they would point out it's in the suburbs, so it's not inner city kids, as if we're only interested in inner city kids, you know, that it is, and that it's a very small school, and I think that in some sense allowed them to dismiss it. It was kind of, at that time, one of a kind. There was Summerhill in England, but that was regarded by most people even at that time as something of the past, even though it still exists. Mm-hmm. People in people's minds, that was something from the past, and it was a fad, and now it's gone, that free school kind of thing. So I think that people just couldn't take it seriously. I think there's a deeper reason that even today people in education are not very interested in this school. And that's really that if this were the model of education, education professors in schools of education would be irrelevant. We wouldn't have them. We wouldn't need them.
And so much.
We would still need people who are into various fields, but we wouldn't need anybody who's into things like how to design a curriculum because there's still curriculum. How to enforce discipline in the classroom, because that's taken care of by the democratic process.
It would kill off the educational industrial complex, the textbook manufacturers.
I think one of the reasons this kind of school, you ask the question, here's this school's been around almost half a century. It is demonstrably successful. There are now some schools modeled after it, which are also successful, so we know it's replicable. And there's nothing unique about this school. It's not the particular staff members who are there or anything like that. And yet, even today, the educational establishment isn't interested in it. And why is that? I think it's partly because there's no when it comes right down to it, most human beings are self-interested. They're interested mm-hmm. in things that promote what they do. So educators are interested in promoting, their job. Textbook sellers are interested in promoting their textbooks and so on and so forth. There's no vested interest in Sudbury Valley outside of the kids' vested interests themselves and those few parents who send there. There's nobody who can make money on this thing, mm-hmm. So there's nobody who has a reason to try to sell it.
And that's a recurring theme that we talk about is the whole idea of following the money when it comes to these issues, and it all leads back to, like you say, these self-interested groups. So parents, I having a vested interest, there are a lot of parents out there, and the group of us here see this on social media a lot. There are a lot of teachers out there in the public school system that are getting very frustrated with the testing and the high pressure and all this. There are a lot of parents that are getting frustrated with it and looking at alternatives like homeschooling and unschooling. What do we need to do to change this system? Does it have to be a parental revolt? Does it have to be just parents deciding not to have their kids show up to school anymore? How do we change?
Yeah, that's a really good question, and I've given a lot of thought to that. I'm part of a group that has a website called alternativestoschooling.com, and we also call it the Tipping Point Project, because the rationale of this is that the way the educational system is going to change is not from within. It can't possibly change from within. It's just too, you know, it's like the dinosaurs couldn't change. They couldn't evolve to meet the new conditions of the world. So they went extinct. They were replaced by these little mouse-like mammals that grew up ultimately and proliferated. And just as the dinosaurs couldn't change because they were already so overbuilt for a certain kind of set of functions that no longer was worked, the same is true for schools. If you were to design schools to really promote learning, they would be absolutely nothing like what schools are. Nothing like them.
No.
So you can't just gradually in some way modify it. You can't take, people are always asking, well, how could we incorporate into a public school some aspect of Sudbury Valley to make the public school better? And I really end up being kind of at a loss, because you can't really just take one piece of it without taking the rest. You know, you can't do away with grades, let's say, unless you completely changed other aspects of the system. Because if you do away with grades, then people are no longer going to follow the curriculum.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yeah. So you've got the age mixing. You can't segregate kids. A school like Sudbury Valley can't work if you segregated the kids, because mostly they're learning from one another. Little kids are learning from older kids. They're playing with older kids and learning more sophisticated activities. They're getting interested in reading because they see older kids read. So you couldn't possibly do anything like Sudbury Valley if it were a graded school. You know, so you've got to change the whole thing. And you just can't do that within the system.
Yeah. And so is change going to happen because small groups are going to just decide to pull out? I mean, homeschooling numbers have been going up.
That's right. I think that the reason it's going to change in what's already happening is that there's an ever-increasing rate of flow of families out of public schools and standard private schools as well. More people doing homeschooling among the homeschoolers. There's no real statistics on this, but my impression is that among the homeschoolers, there's ever more people who are so-called relaxed homeschoolers or unschoolers, where the kids are really kind of in charge of their own learning and their own curriculum, or there is no curriculum. Even though it's still very small, there is a growing number of Sudbury-type model schools and other democratic schools that are somewhat like Sudbury Valley. And as this occurs, it's still, though, a small number. Still, the great majority of people are going to regular schools, and we are constantly, every day, being bombarded with propaganda from everybody, from the President of the United States on down, uh-huh. about how important school is and how important, you know, now the expectation is everybody's supposed to go to college. So, you know, so that's going to become just like a continuation of high school.
Yeah, now,
So we hear that, people hear that propaganda all the time. Most families come from at least three generations of people who went to school. So it's very hard for people to imagine that, even if they hear of somebody who did it or of two or three people who did it, it's very hard for them to imagine that it's possible to develop in a reasonable way such that you can get a job, that you can have a happy and productive life if you don't do school.
Yeah. And on the other end of the spectrum, you know, our experience is all in the early years, preschool, and one thing we're noticing is that, and at one time that was a place where there was more democracy and more freedom and more play than any place in the whole educational system. And now 3-year-olds are turning into 5-year-olds, and 5-year-olds expected to be 8-year-olds. We've pushed that curriculum down, and we've taken the broken prison style model of the elementary school and pushed that down onto 2- and 3- and 4-year-olds. And so we're starting to break children sooner. And in our perspective, we're seeing a lot more rebellion from caregivers in that system. And again, it all goes back to that money, because you got to get the money for scoring well on the standardized testing when you're in fourth grade. So you got to start pushing that when you're 2.5 years old.
I know. Yeah. It's that's right. So I'm often invited to speak to conferences of early educators, and they are really on, you know, wherever they are, they know kids well enough to realize that it's just silly to be asking little kids to do academic work.
Yeah.
They can see how much kids learn when in free play, and they can see how important that is, and they really resent the fact that they're being required more and more to teach as if these are kids who are, you know, in classrooms
and they're getting,
rather than playrooms.
Getting more and more frustrated and feeling more and more broken by the system. Hey, when I emailed, I said we'd try to keep it around half an hour. We've hit that. Do you have a couple more minutes for us, or shall we
sure.
wrap it up?
I could go a couple more minutes.
I got a big question I got to ask. Lisa did, she has a book group in Rochester, New York, and your book was one of the books that came up, and everybody loved it, but somebody had a bit of a problem, and you got to chime in here, Lisa, if I get it wrong, but she thought the whole hunter-gatherer thing and the connection you made there, somebody was just kind of not jiving with that, and I think it's spot on.
Oh,
because
no, I
oh
think
go
it,
ahead
I,
get
no,
me get me
was,
right
it was spot on, but I think that she got stuck there and thought that the comparison was too much. And what was interesting to me is that she's probably one of the most eloquent people in our group, and it was very surprising to me to hear her share that. And she was able to still participate, and we had a great conversation about the book. But I'm wondering if you've gotten that feedback from it. I personally disagreed with her, but that's neither here nor there. Have you gotten that feedback before at all?
Well, I think I have on occasion. I mean, it's interesting. I've presented this work to groups of anthropologists. You know, I'm not really an anthropologist, so when I did that research interviewing anthropologists, some of the findings were surprising to me. And so when I actually wrote a paper about the play life of anthropologists. Of hunter gatherers, and about the extraordinary autonomy that hunter-gatherer children are allowed, and how they hunter-gatherers believe the children learn through play. And I was actually quite surprised by the consistency of the reports from the anthropologists on this. I think it's very relevant because it tells us something about children's capacities, and it tells us something about, from a very different culture from ours, of course, how parents have such an entirely different view than our culture has about the purpose of development. Now, I believe that this way, this attitude, this way of life, maybe not everything about contemporary hunter-gatherers represents the way our ancestors lived for hundreds of thousands of years, but I believe that this aspect of it probably does, because this characterizes hunter-gatherers of all types. And there's no reason to believe that going back in the prehistory of human beings that there was anything like school, or that there was anything like the idea that parents are responsible for making their children learn. So the reason that's all relevant is it tells us why children are the way they are. Children are really designed to control their own education. They're designed to be willful. They're designed to rebel the way my son was rebelling because they want to be in charge of their own learning, and they want to decide what they're going to learn. They need those conditions in order to be able to do it with enthusiasm, in order to do it well. And I think the hunter-gatherer story explains that. Now, where it sidetracks people is that some people say, well, of course, we're not hunter-gatherers, and there's so many different things that we have to learn that they didn't have to learn. And my answer to that is twofold. One is, there's a hell of a lot, actually, that we do have to learn that they had to learn. I think many of the most important things, the hardest and most important things to learn are not reading and writing. The hardest and most important things to learn are how to get along with other people, how to control your emotions.
Absolutely.
How to organize your own day, how to take responsibility for yourself. These are the things that, whether you're a hunter-gatherer, whether you're a child in our society, you are learning them in play, and that's the only place you can learn them. Hunter-gatherers practice bow and arrow shooting in their play and tracking game. These are terribly difficult skills, and they practice it in play because it's important to their culture. Uh-huh. Not surprising to me that kids in our culture practice computers. They play, that's the big tool in our culture. They play with computers. They play with words. They play with numbers. They play with the things that are important to our culture. So to me, it's not at all far-fetched to believe that an analysis of how children learn in hunter-gatherer cultures is relevant to thinking about how children learn in our culture.
I think you referred to it as a new to you. I believe at some point in the book is that it's not that the model itself is new, but it was new potentially to the people who were reading about it in your book, because we had kind of either become detached or lost faith in that system and method that served us well for way more time than most people realized. And I think that was a big takeaway for me from your book.
Well, and really, as far as the human brain goes, we're essentially hunter-gatherers with iPhones. I mean, as far as
there's been very, very little biological evolution, no significant biological evolution over the last 10,000 years since we've had agriculture.
I think it's spot on, because if you watch a mixed-age group of kids playing outside on a summer, in the few places that actually still happens, you see it just seems natural that for tens and hundreds of thousands of years, that's the way little humans grew up to be us.
Yeah.
Is that playing on the fringes and playing with adult tools and playing at adult activities and working on those social skills. It just makes sense. It just feels right in my experience.
I don't even know what the phrase would be, but I enjoyed reading your book. Once I plowed through it, just read it, and then I went back through with that fine-tooth comb and the two colors of highlighters, and then I wrote a book report on it, which essentially it wasn't even able to be a book report. It just turned into, here are the amazing sound bites from this book by each chapter. And I'm not just saying that to offer like a pat on the back. I mean, I was really, really taken by what you put to pen, as Jeff said, that you penned. And I actually said in the start of my book report that I think we finally found somebody who said it the way that it needed to be said. And instead of just offering that things need to be changed, I actually felt that you offered a blueprint for the people who are willing to say, we don't need to just go in and give schools a remodel. They need to be completely rebuilt. And for anybody who's at that point in their own career or their own path that they're willing to take that on, I really do believe that your book provided a not a prescription, but a way to actually approach that. And it was amazing. And I'm above honored that I'm sitting at a table right now listening to your words. I'm a little speechless. A little bit.
Thank you. I feel very humbled and flattered.
We appreciate
you.
I've got one more silly, stupid question, Peter. As we've been interviewing people over the last couple of days, and what we do is we get together twice a year and record a bunch of episodes. Chickens have come up. We talked to a family child care provider in Idaho, and she had a chicken coop in her family child care program, and the kids helped with the chickens and the eggs. And then we talked to author Heather Shoemaker, who wrote It's Okay Not to Share, and she raises chickens, and I'm just wondering, do you have a chicken story, any chicken experiences?
<There's a theme. laughs> No.
I didn't know. I just had to ask. I didn't know if you would. But how can people, where should people, if people want more Peter Gray in their lives, where do they go?
Oh, goodness. Well, I've written a lot of academic articles, if people want to look at those, where, you know, I delve more into the, you know, more into the research than I do in the book on some of these topics. Do look at our website, alternativestolearning.com, which gives, which includes, not just from me, but from a number of people, links to lots of different articles, gives encouragement for people, answers questions for people who are thinking about some kind of self-directed learning approach for their children, provides resources or links to resources. So that, I think, is a useful thing to look at. You know, there's one more thing I should probably say. I have this sense of incompletion in that I had started to answer the question about how the educational system is going to change, and then I allowed myself to sort of digress.
I probably digressed you
onto that, and I never quite completed it. So just in the word, I think that is going to change by virtue of once we reach a tipping point, once there's enough people, whether it's 10% or 15% of families that are not sending their children to a typical school but have embraced some kind of self-directed learning for their children, and then everybody will know people who are doing this. They will have friends, they'll have relatives, they'll have neighbors who are doing this. And once that happens, then I think that there will be a landslide in this direction, because people will see it works and they will say, why should I be fighting with my child to make my child go to school when so-and-so next door is doing just fine and they have a happy family and nobody's going to school there? So, yeah. You know, I see it as a little bit analogous to other kinds of social revolutions that have occurred. I mean, think about in, you know, just in the last decade or so, the revolution that has occurred in our understanding of homosexuality and our acceptance of that as a normal condition. There were decades, centuries in which you had to stay in the closet, but then there were these brave people who came out of the closet and who dared to say, I'm gay, who marched and said, I'm gay, and pretty soon many of the people who were so adamantly believing that being gay is sinful, if they were religious or believing that it's a sickness, if they were secular, suddenly could no longer say that, because they said, oh my gosh, you know, my uncle is gay, or my cousin, or so-and-so down the street, and gee, they're perfectly nice and normal people. I think that when, you know, the analogy is not perfect, but I think that when we see that there's lots of nice and normal and successful people who are not going to school, it'll be easy for people to accept that it's okay not to go to school.
Mm-hmm. Come out of the closet.
I think some
kind of coming out of the closet for people who are believers.
I've actually seen that with homeschooling, Peter. It's kind of like blossom. Somebody does it, and you see this on social media because people post about it, and then other people are saying, well, how do you do that? And the questions are asked, and it is demystified, and people are more comfortable with it. I think that's spot on. And I want to throw this out there. We've, between Lisa and Tasha and myself, we've got some fairly decent followings on social media. So, as your work moves forward, if there's anything that we can do to help promote things and get messages out, we by all means want to be able to help with that, because it's important stuff you're doing, and we want to help be a voice for it.
Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate that.
Well, thank you,
appreciate
Peter, and we'll wrap it up, and we appreciate your time so much. This has been another episode of the Child Care Bar and Grill podcast. We'll be back next week, and won't we be with somebody as fancy as Peter Gray? This is kind of awesome. Thanks for listening. Bye-bye. I got to turn off the microphone.